God save the king and rule Britannia. My name is Patrick Brown, and you're listening to Crown and Crozier. To mark the occasion of the crowning of Britain's new king and Canada's new head of state, in this episode, we welcome a special guest from the other side of the Atlantic. Anne Widdecombe served as a Conservative Member of Parliament in the British House of Commons from 1987 to 2010. During that time, she held several cabinet portfolios, and early on in her tenure, she converted to the Catholic faith. She also held a seat in the European Parliament as a representative of the Brexit Party from 2019 to 2020. A well-known political commentator and public personality, Anne makes the case for why Britain's withdrawal from the European Union was necessary and why it was fully in line with Catholic social teaching on subsidiarity. She also reflects on her conversion, the future of the Anglican Church, the present state of conservatism in the United Kingdom, and the first coronation of a British monarch in 70 years. Thanks for listening in, and please enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, but God's first.
Anne Widdecombe, welcome to Crown and Crozier. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Looking forward to covering a lot of ground with you today in terms of major issues in the public square and in the life of the church in modern-day Britain. For today's conversations, and particularly in light of your experience and expertise, I'd like to start with the issue that has arguably dominated the political discourse in the United Kingdom in recent years, and that is the country's withdrawal from the European Union, otherwise known as Brexit. So I'm going to tee off the conversation as follows. 3 years have elapsed since Brexit took effect, in late January 2020. There have been some implementation agreements over the years to move things along and make it happen. In your view, has the early experience in the recent 3 years post-withdrawal, has it vindicated the decision?
Well, I believe that the decision is fully vindicated, but what I also think is that we simply haven't taken advantage of the benefits of Brexit. There's been no advantage taken of our ability to set different VAT levels, for example. That's value-added tax for your listeners. No efforts either to become competitive with Europe. For example, in the last budget, the Chancellor raised our corporation tax to the level of France. Now, what he should be doing is lowering corporation tax in order to get big companies to come to Britain. No advantage has been taken for various reasons. But let us, for example, look at the recent big deal that we got with the Pacific countries. That deal gives us access to the fastest growing of the big economic blocks. And not only that, but strange, isn't it? They don't seem to feel it necessary to interfere in UK law just because we've got a trading agreement. And that was the problem with the EU. We joined what was then called the European Economic Community. We thought it was a trading arrangement. It turned out to be a superstate and political control. Didn't turn out to be that by the middle of Tuesday afternoon. Took a very long time. But in the end, that is not only what it became, but what it dropped all pretensions to being otherwise. And it quite clearly wanted one superstate, one flag, one army, one currency, and it wasn't necessary merely to trade.
So may I ask, I mean, it sounds like you're saying the decision has been vindicated, the framework has been set, the door has been opened for Britain to drive through and take full advantage of this new arrangement if it chooses to. In the initial 3 years that have elapsed since Brexit, what tangible benefits or advantages would you point to in terms of vindication of the decision?
First of all the numbers of trade deals that we've done, which we couldn't do while we were in the EU, absolutely forbidden under the terms of the EU. The EU, when we joined it as the EEC, accounted for 20% of global trade. Impressive. It's now 8%. But the Pacific bloc is not according to us, but according to OECD itself, the fastest growing. Therefore, we've moved from a declining market share to a fast growing market share. Now, that couldn't have been done so long as we were tied into Brexit. And actually, it gives me great hope for the future, because if efforts are ever made to rejoin, that trading agreement is going to stand in the way. And we will be asking ourselves, do we really want to give up something this big? I think that is the major achievement. There could have been so many other achievements, but there haven't been, not because of Brexit, but because of the absence of will to take advantage of it.
You served as a member of European Parliament for the Brexit Party from 2019 to 2020. When you were in that assembly, what exact arguments were you making to your fellow legislators around the rationale and the motive and the appetite for withdrawal?
Well, in a way, I didn't need to make the argument because it had been made for us. Britain had already voted to leave. Boris Johnson had won, or did very shortly after we joined the European Parliament, that is, he won a massive majority on the basis of get Brexit done. So in a way, we didn't have to make that case. But I did say, in one of my last speeches there, I did say, if the vision for the EU had been the same as the original vision, there would have been no Brexit. Brexit has happened because we were not prepared to be controlled by a superstate. We didn't want to be part of that superstate. We wanted to be a sovereign state, but in a trading agreement.
You mentioned the referendum that occurred in 2016 in the United Kingdom. I'm a big fan of Jane Austen novels. And there was a moment from the referendum campaign that really stuck out with me. I remember watching some media coverage, and there was a shot of a chalkboard outside of a restaurant somewhere in England. And this chalkboard framed the referendum in the following terms: Pride and Prejudice versus Sense and Sensibility. So that is, Pride and Prejudice were the motives and the defining characteristics of the Leave camp, whereas Sense and Sensibility were the defining characteristics of the Remain camp. So that is, if you were motivated to leave, chances are you had animus towards outsiders and foreigners. And if you wanted to stay in the EU, you were enlightened and civilized and progressive. Where does that argument break down in your view?
Typically arrogant Remainer argument. You know, that's what the line they took all along was. People who were in favour of Brexit are all ignoramuses. You know, they're all prejudiced against immigration. They've all got this little England agenda. Whereas these people said, you know, if you were Remain, you had a vision of the future. Well, yes, we had a vision of the future and where it was taking us, you know, 20% to 8%. I do think we had pride. I think we're very proud of Britain. I think we're proud of what we can achieve if we're left alone to do it. I do think we had pride in as much as we didn't want our laws dictated by a foreign body. And that indeed was my overwhelming reason for wanting to leave, was because I wanted sovereignty. I wanted Britain to run its own laws, its own trade deals, its own borders, and to be free to do so. I say, yes, I think there was an element of pride. There wasn't any element of prejudice. I don't think there was much sense at all in the Remain campaign. There was some. But in the end, it was defeatist. It was saying, look, you know, if we come out, the consequences will be so unimaginable. And indeed, we had some of those painted for us, what was called Project Fear. You know, Cameron and Osborne, we were going to have an emergency budget. We didn't. We were going to have an immediate collapse in employment. We didn't, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they really thought that. And they also thought that, well, it's very enlightened to be pro-European. But why isn't it enlightened to be pro-Canadian, pro-Commonwealth, pro-Singapore? Mm-hmm. You know, why isn't that enlightened as well? What's so special about Europe? So I think that was a false proposition that the restaurant put out. But it was very funny. And I'm sure if I'd passed by, I would have laughed.
A lot of what you're saying is resonating quite strongly. I am going to play devil's advocate with a specific analogy. So here in Canada, for better or for worse, our economic livelihood in the modern context is deeply tied to our integration with our neighbors to the south, the United States. And for any politician in Canada to advocate for disentanglement from our economic integration with the United States, I mean, that would be political suicide, potentially leading to economic suicide, depending on which observers and experts you're asking. Why is that not the case for the United Kingdom? I mean, the European Union is a massive neighbor in your backyard, and there's a perception that Brexit meant an economic disentanglement from your largest, most proximate partner. So where does that analogy break down?
I'll tell you exactly where it breaks down. I'm not aware that the United States has taken control of Canadian law. Now, I may be quite wrong. Perhaps it has. Perhaps the United States has also taken control of your borders. I don't know about this, but maybe it's taken control of your trade deals as well. Whereas, you know, that is exactly what Europe has done to us. Now, I was a minister for nearly 7 years, so I do know what I'm talking about. And we could not pass laws that we wanted to pass if the EU did not want them. And similarly, if the EU decided to impose law on us, which we did not want, we still had to have it. Now, that does not describe the relationship between the United States and Canada.
No, it does not.
Absolutely nowhere.
If this is what many Britons were feeling and the British government was feeling based on their experience with membership in the EU, what motivates the other countries to remain?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think if we had made a better fist of leaving, we might have by now seen some movement, say, towards Italexit, for example, because there was a time when there were terrible tensions between Italy and the EU. There are still some tensions between Hungary and the EU. I know myself of people who support Frexit, you know, which really would be something, because if France came out, well, you know, I mean, they're one of the major partners. You know, there was some talk of it. We made a hash of Brexit. Let's face that. I've said that many, many times. If we had treated it, seized it by the scruff of the neck, gone for being competitive, gone for being Singapore on Thames, I think, you know, it might well be that other countries would have looked at us and decided to follow. But it doesn't follow that the EU will always be what it is now. And I think that is a mistake that Remainers sometimes make. They wanted to feel safe. They wanted nothing to move, nothing to change. But things do change. They change anyway. And the EU that we joined, you know, the original EU before we joined was only six nations. You know, now look at it, 27. Things change. And I don't necessarily think that the EU will be there in exactly the same form in 15, 20 years' time.
Well, this is a Catholic podcast, and I want to make sure to bring in some Catholic principles and flavor, which is relevant here. And in particular, I want to focus on the principle of Catholic social teaching around subsidiarity. And just as a reminder to our listeners, the Catechism defines subsidiarity as a community of a higher order should not interfere in the internal life of the community of a community of a lower order, but rather should support it in case of need and help to coordinate its activity with the activities of the rest of society, always with a view to the common good. It seems to me that that definition and concept of subsidiarity would serve as justification or certainly support some of the rationale which you put forward and which you and your colleagues advocated for around the Brexit debate. Was subsidiarity something that informed your approach and drove your actions?
We call it something different. We call it sovereignty. But it's exactly the same principle. I mean, we didn't see why we had to be governed by Brussels. And indeed, minute parts of our law were being governed by Brussels, you know, things which affected local communities, etc. I think very much we're in line with Catholic social teaching, those of us who believed in Brexit. And indeed, if you'd put a full stop after your introductory sentence, I would have said to you, well, that's the EU excommunicated, isn't it?
So, when you put it that way, I'm just curious, did the word subsidiarity appear in the political debate and discourse in Britain, or was it used or applied, but perhaps in different terms?
Oh, I'm sure it was used and applied, but as I say, we call it sovereignty. We call it Britain deciding, you know, on British affairs. Yes, I mean, subsidiarity was being discussed, but it was called sovereignty.
Given all of the spirit, all of the messiness that went into the debate around Brexit and what has ensued post-withdrawal and the various implementation mechanisms and what have you, could you contemplate a scenario where some years down the road, the United Kingdom says, you know what, our bad, we want back in?
No. And there are several reasons for that. The first is it's not a simple case of just going back in. Mm-hmm. You would have to apply to rejoin from scratch. You would have to accept the euro, for example, which we never did. That was something that at least we had the good sense not to concede. We would have to accept the euro. We would have to pay a huge rejoining fee. we would have to open up our borders again. We would have to resurrender control back to the EU. And crucially, we would have to give up all these trade deals that we've done. Because they're fairly recent, I think people aren't really, they're not embedded in people's consciousness. But certainly, you know, some years down the line, they are going to be. And if we're asked, do you want to give up this? As I say, you know, a growing market for a falling one, which is the state of play at the moment. The answer would almost certainly be no. So I don't think we'd rejoin. What I think is a more likely scenario is that future governments will do what this government is doing and just shadow the EU. I mean, not be competitive with it, not call them out, not say, look, this is what you can do. And that, I mean, exactly what the Chancellor did in the budget. That, I think, is the much greater threat, which is that very simply we'll shadow the EU without being in it. Now, you know, I heard strong arguments during the referendum for staying in. I heard much stronger arguments for coming out, but I never heard a single argument at any time for coming out and acting as if we were still in.
Brexit was achieved under a Conservative government, courtesy of support from a sizable majority of Conservative members of Parliament. There was a spirited debate, nevertheless, and some sharp disagreements within the Conservative caucus around Brexit, related to the merit of the different proposals, the mechanics of implementation. So in retrospect, how do you reflect on what the issue of Brexit and the debate around Brexit meant for conservatism in Britain? Was it a high watermark? Was it a defining existential moment? What are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, the Conservatives were deeply divided on Europe. So were the Labour Party. The Lib Dems were not. They've always been very pro-European. But as I always used to say, you know, there are two views on Europe in the Conservative Party. There are two in the Labour Party, and there are two in the country as a whole. It was always going to be the case that when the question was finally put, after years and years of trying to get it put, there was always going to be a very, very divisive atmosphere. In fact, at one stage, I called it an unarmed civil war. You know, things were so bad, friends weren't talking to each other and all this sort of nonsense. I think, yes, it did affect the Conservative Party. And what is more, will affect the Conservative Party for some time to come, because these great divisions take time to heal, and you can't really heal until you've... I mean, we had to have Brexit in order even to start the healing, because until you'd got Brexit, the arguments were going on. But you think of the English Civil War. Not everybody was cheering at the Restoration, just as not everybody was cheering when Cromwell seized control. And that went on for a long time. And I accept that until people really, really get used to the fact that we have left, we are not going back, until they get used to that fact and see Britain developing on different lines, there will be divisions, and in the Conservative Party as well as anywhere else.
You served as a Conservative Member of Parliament for 23 years. Since you were first elected in 1987, in the 36 ensuing years, Conservative prime ministers have governed the United Kingdom for about 60% of that time, 22 of the 36 years, approximately. How has the party evolved more generally since you first held office?
Oh, it's changed. It has undeniably changed. First of all, I think quality, and this is not peculiar to the Conservative Party, the quality of parliamentarian and increasingly also of the House of Lords is much lower than it was. And that partly stems from an obsession with identity politics, with having so many women and so many this and so many that, rather than going purely on merit as it used to. So the first thing I would say is quality's decline. Second thing I would say is we have evolved into, at the moment, a pretty left-wing party. Now, in the Thatcher years, we were a right-wing party. In the major years, we were still pretty right-wing. But we're now almost indistinguishable from Labour on the social issues of the day. I mean, if you look at the woke debate, for example, the Conservatives are no different from Labour. So I think we've lost a lot of identity as a Conservative Party. And I think until we regain that ground of economic competence, competitiveness, common sense, I think we will go on lacking identity. And I think that's the problem at the moment. Nobody ever said to me in my youth on doorsteps, nobody ever said to me, you're all the same. It doesn't make any difference. Now you get that all the time because people genuinely can't see a major philosophical divide?
I think I can anticipate the answer to this question, but I can't resist from asking. Your time in Parliament overlapped with the premiership of Margaret Thatcher for a few years, Lady Thatcher. What do you think Lady Thatcher would say about today's Conservative Party? Would she recognize it?
She wouldn't recognize it. And I think she would roll her eyes in sheer disbelief. She wouldn't believe where it's gone. Because her idea of conservatism was very much a party for the individual, for individual enterprise, for individual effort, for a party where if you had abilities, you could always get on. She was very, very much for the individual, and she was for giving disadvantaged individuals a chance. For example, the sale of council houses was specifically designed to ensure that people who never thought they could be homeowners, you know, they thought that was for other people. They just couldn't aspire to that. She taught them that they could aspire to that. And to this day, I get people saying to me, oh, my parents were able to buy their own home because of Mrs. Thatcher. To this day, I get people saying that. So she had a very, very strong ethos of individuality, which I think is gone.
Do you have a favorite Iron Lady story or anecdote?
I don't actually think I do. And it's for this reason that when I went in, I was a backbencher. Margaret Thatcher had already been Prime Minister for 8 years by the time I arrived in Parliament. And for the first 3 years that I was there, until I became a minister in 1990, I was purely a backbencher. So I didn't have a lot of contact with her in the way that so many others did. But I think that what a lot of people will remember is her last speech in Parliament, when she was as bullish could be, you know, and she'd just been deposed by the party. And she was really forceful. And in the middle of it, she said, I'm enjoying this. And, you know, it just gobsmacked people.
Across the pond here in North America, there's a sense that certainly in conservative circles, those for whom the Christian faith plays a central, profoundly important role in their lives, and they not only accept, but they celebrate and embrace the teachings of Christianity, which run against the grain of contemporary culture. So in this regard, I'm thinking of examples like the sanctity of human life and the grave evil of abortion, or the reality of male and female representing two distinct biological sexes. For these folks, there's a sense that politically, the only home for them is either mainstream conservative parties, or here in a Canadian context, alternative conservative parties that have recently emerged. Is it a similar situation in Britain at all along these lines?
Well, it's very, very similar, in as much as people do tend to think the Conservative Party is more socially conservative, not just economically, but socially conservative as well. And certainly the big option that, you know, people like me offer people is now being offered through alternative parties. Initially the Brexit Party, now the Reform Party, to which I belong. And so, yes, I mean, there is a similarity there. But the sad thing is that both major parties are signed up to modern culture rather than to principles which I hold very dear. Abortion up to birth. Now, admittedly, on a free vote, it wasn't done by compulsion. But abortion up to birth, which came in 1990 in our country, came in under a Conservative government. There is no doubt about that. At all. Gay marriage came in under a Conservative government. The woke culture is not being fought particularly hard. There are signs, and at least we have a Prime Minister who does know what a male and a female are. I mean, unlike the Leader of the Opposition, who refuses to say what a woman is. But even there, you know, they're trying to accommodate the trans agenda and not offend anybody. And certainly, you know, nobody has taken action about the fact that we've had several arrests of people who were doing no more than praying outside abortion clinics, praying in their heads, not praying openly and aggressively, but just standing there praying as individuals, you know, not great groups of people intimidating individuals. So that's happened under Conservative government and nothing's being done about it. The courts threw it out, I'm glad to say. So I don't think you'll find that people believe that the Conservative government has the answers to social conservatism anymore. Whereas there was a time, you're quite right, when it would have been very clear indeed that this was the party you stayed in if you wanted social conservatism, with a small c.
Someone like yourself served as a member of parliament for over 2 decades, served in the European Parliament. You've been a major voice and name in the conservative movement in your home country. I see a lot of echoes and parallels with what we're experiencing here in Canada, and I'm sure in the United States it's the same thing. But for young conservatives who are passionate about small c conservative fundamentals and principles, there's this tension. Do I invest the time and energy and effort in the mainstream established party, or do I take my political engagement to an alternative party whose electoral prospects may be dim? How would you counsel a young individual in that situation?
I think one has to be brave. Now, my views on this have turned 180 degrees. There was a time when I would have said, look, you know, the only two parties that are ever going to hold any real power in this country are the Conservatives and the Labour Party. You pay your money and you make your choice. And neither is going to be perfect for whatever it is you want. But that's, you know, politics is the art of compromise. That's what I would once have said. However, I now feel so let down by the Conservative Party that I think the future has to lie in replacing them. And in replacing them with a genuinely conservative party, as opposed to a pale pink socialist party. And so nowadays, I would say to such a young person, be brave, join Reform or whoever, you know, it's up to you, but because if they're socialists, they want to do something else. But be brave and join a smaller party. And remember that new parties do sometimes win. I mean, Macron could tell you that in France, you know, new parties do sometimes win. So don't give up before you've even started. That would now be my advice. But I also face reality. And the chances are that we are going to have this two-party situation for the foreseeable future, but not the endless future. History is change.
As I was preparing for this discussion, I was struck. It's one thing to serve as a person who takes their faith seriously in any national legislature. It's another thing to serve as a person who takes their faith seriously who's in the minority faith in their social and political context. It's yet another thing to serve as a person of faith in a religious minority in a country such as Britain, which has an establishment church, its own church, the Church of England, the Anglican Church. How would you describe your experience in that regard, given the mold that I just described?
Right. Well, I grew up a practicing member of the Anglican Church. My uncle was a vicar. My brother was a vicar. My younger nephew is a vicar. In fact, sometimes I think the Widdicombes existed to keep the Church of England in vicars. So it was genuinely a practicing Anglican household. It wasn't, you know, lip service Anglican. It was really Anglican. However, I became, in the same way I've become in later life disillusioned with the Conservative Party for abandoning its principles, I became very disillusioned with the Church of England because it always seemed to sacrifice faith to fashion and creed to compromise and to just seek to appease in order to fill its pews, which, of course, it never did. The Church of England now is very different from the Church of England when I was growing up, when it really did have a huge say. And was respected. The Archbishop of Canterbury was a very, very respected figure. Now it is completely different. It has embraced the woke agenda. It has apparently no central views at all. You know, individual vicars can make up their views as they go along. And yes, it always was a broad church, but now it appears to have just sunk completely into a modern wokeism, political correctness, all the rest of it. So how does that affect parliamentarians? The answer now is very, very little. Now, there would have been a time when if the church spoke, everybody listened. Now they hardly do. And yes, there are plenty of parliamentarians who are practicing members of the Anglican Church, plenty who are practicing members of the Catholic Church, and all stages in between as well. So religion now, I think in this country, operates very largely outside the church. But when people bemoan the fact that the church doesn't have the clout that it once had, I always say, whose fault is that? You know, it's the fault of individual Christians, because look at the early Christians. They started from nothing. Mm-hmm. They didn't have a whole established church behind them. They started from nothing, and they built Christianity. If they had shown the sort of enthusiasm that we show, we'd all still be worshipping Zeus, quite honestly. You know, we really would.
You converted to Catholicism during your time as a member of parliament, correct?
I was actually a government minister at the time that I converted.
And how did all that go down?
It caused a huge stir at the time. You know, it was front page stuff. There was news media everywhere. There was even foreign news media. And it completely baffled me at the time because I thought, hang on, I'm a junior minister, which I was at the time. I was the lowest form of ministerial life at the time. I'm a junior minister moving from one denomination of Christianity to another. What is all the fuss about? And it was huge. It was vast. I'm not quite sure what people were seeing at the time. Whether they were seeing this is a change, you know, the Catholic Church is going to become dominant, or whether, I really don't know what it was about. But you asked me what it was like, ginormous fuss is all I can say.
These types of experiences and conversions always intrigue me. One question that rises, did you have a community or a sense of camaraderie with fellow Catholic MPs in the House of Commons? I mean, were there many of you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Now, people used to ask me if I was pro-life because I was a Catholic. And I always used to say, no, it works the other way around. I'm almost certainly Catholic because I'm pro-life, because I went to a Catholic school and then I had no contact with Catholicism until I was in my 40s and in Parliament and doing the pro-life bills. And all our support, well, not all our support, that's not true, but most of our support was coming either from the Catholic Church or from the evangelical wing of the Anglican Church. That was where our support was coming from. And so I had more and more to do with Catholics, more and more interaction with them, more and more dependence on them for the support that we were looking for. And therefore, gradually, I suppose I just became curious again about Catholicism, something I hadn't bothered with for a couple of decades.
Converting to Catholicism in that context, I mean, there's a special sense of camaraderie with your fellow members of Parliament in Westminster. Is there a special sense of camaraderie for English Anglicans who convert to Catholicism? I mean, it seems to me like you join a pretty awesome, distinguished club. The Newmans, the Chestertons. Reflect on that a little, if you could.
And we always think we're so frightfully superior because, of course, when we convert, you have to say at the moment of your reception, and you have to say it aloud and individually, I believe all the Catholic Church teaches to be revealed truth. Now, no cradle Catholic ever has to say that. You know, you can develop doubts about half the canon and you can still turn up for communion. You know, there is no penalty, if you like. But a convert will not be accepted unless he can say that. And so the bar is very, very high for converts. And yes, we have quite a history. You're quite right. Newman's the obvious one. Chesterton's another. There are all sorts. And probably Charles II was one on his deathbed, though we're not entirely certain, but it is extremely likely. So, yes, I mean, it is a distinguished club. And yeah, we do think, you know, we're a bit more rabid than the cradle Catholics. But that's a bit of a joke. I don't want 1,000 emails telling me why not. So have we joined an exclusive club? Yes. But the most important thing is join the Catholic Church.
And not to approach the issue specifically or squarely in these terms, but is that club growing? I mean, do you still have people in your circle of acquaintance and friendships who are leaving the Anglican faith and joining the Catholic Church?
Yes. Obviously, there was a mass exodus after the priesting of women at the end of 92. Very big exodus in 93. Something like 5 bishops, 300-odd clergy, thousands and thousands of laity. Now, that was huge, but there is still a steady trickle, not a big flood like that, but a steady trickle of people. And everywhere I go, I meet them, including, I mean, fairly recently, an Anglican priest. And everywhere I go, I meet them, and people tell me, and they say, well, we're doing what you did, or we have done what you did, or, oh, we beat you to it, we did it before you did. So that, you know, that I meet them all the time.
We're recording this interview just a few short weeks in advance of the coronation of King Charles III on May the 6th. In the lead up to the coronation, what do you find yourself thinking and reflecting upon, just in general terms?
I really hope that whatever else happens, that Charles, in his coronation service, does pledge absolutely to uphold the Church of England as the faith of this country, which it is. Now, other faiths are obviously going to be welcome at the coronation, and why not? There is no good reason why not. But the faith of this country is Christian and is Anglican, and I've never denied that, is Anglican. And therefore, you know, our monarch is the supreme governor of the Church of England, and I very much hope that he upholds it in his coronation speech. There'll be a Catholic bishop there. There'll be probably the Archbishop of Westminster. There will be people from other faith communities there. But what I want to hear Charles say is that it's the Christian faith which he is going to uphold principally.
Is there a specific oath? The acceding monarch usually says
it. Yeah, there is a specific oath. And the Queen took it. But I think the King considers that times having changed somewhat. You know, he's going to modernise the service, and he has already modernised it. He's cut it into half its size. He's rather depressingly told peers that they don't have to wear their robes and coronets, which, you know, is not actually going to make this coronation day memorable in the minds of viewers who are watching the ceremony. You know, they'll want colour, they'll want pageantry, which Britain's so good at. They'll want horses and carriages and robes and coronets and never mind all the modern stuff. That's what people will want. And I've got a horrible feeling he's going to ration it.
This is a potential watershed, if not existential moment for the British monarchy. Is that going too far, or is that a fair characterization?
No, I don't think it's going too far at all. I mean, the coronation is a very defining moment. It is we've already got the reign, but it is the confirmation of the reign of the monarch and the beginning of a new age. The Carolean Age, we're calling it, as opposed to the Second Elizabethan. It is important, and I don't describe it as a watershed in as much as I think if it is dull, people will be terribly disappointed. But, I mean, there isn't going to be a revolution tomorrow morning. But the monarchy depends on staying popular and relevant. Now, Charles is very focused on relevant. He should also remember popular and remember what people like me want. You know, we want to see British pageantry. Nobody else does it as well. Everybody knows that. The rest of the world knows that. That's why they're tuning in. That's why billions will tune in. It's to see a spectacle.
It sounds like there is a risk here. If the pomp and pageantry is minimized, then either deliberately or inadvertently by extension, the Christian character of the ceremony is going to be minimized.
Well, that depends. I mean, the Christian character of the ceremony, I will depend entirely on what the wording is and what is said. And of course, the role of the Archbishop is supreme. You know, he's going to be doing the coronation. So there's no argument at all. It will be an Anglican service. So I don't really worry about the pageantry affecting the Christian bit of it. What I think the pageantry could cause, or rather absence of pageantry could cause, is just a lot of people to shrug, you know, very disappointedly. As I say, it won't mean a revolution tomorrow morning, but it will mean people becoming that less loving towards the monarchy. And I think the king should go for all the pageantry in the world.
What do you think the mood of the country is like? And maybe in conjunction with that, what is the health of the social and political fabric of Britain at this moment? And what does that mean for the type of coronation that the country needs at this moment?
Oh, I think the country is enormously looking forward to the coronation. I mean, really enormously. They're all planning street parties and the atmosphere in this country at the moment, you know, it's all about the coronation. No newspaper sells unless it's got some coronation story. And Britain's looking forward to the coronation. It's looking forward to it as a relief from what is a pretty miserable time at the moment. It's looking for something to cheer them up. Because if you actually consider, you know, we've got massive inflation, we've got strikes right, left and centre, we've got a pretty miserable time, and people want relief from it. And if the king gives them that, you know, it'll be wonderful. They'd want to have a few days when they can enjoy being British, enjoy the pageantry, enjoy the show, which they know they're not going to see, you know, many of us at any rate, aren't going to see again in our lifetime. Enjoy the show, have fun, have the street parties, and forget for the space of a few days the realities of modern life in Britain, which are pretty grim at the moment.
I take that on one level in terms of what's happening at the surface, but at a deeper level, I mean, it does really sound like a genuine opportunity to put the full fruits and riches of a Christian monarchical tradition on display and to have that uplift the people.
No, it doesn't. No, it isn't. As I say, the ceremony itself will be Christian, it will be Anglican, the Archbishop will be the principal player. So the ceremony itself is going to be Christian, and I have no doubt about that. But all the rest of the stuff, all the rejoicing around it, is just very frothy. But it's a froth that people need at the moment. Just as in 1981 was also quite miserable economically, but the marriage of the then Prince and Princess of Wales was wonderful because everybody thought it was a new future dawning, and you know, and wasn't it marvellous? And it was fairy tale wedding. People, if you like, suspended disbelief. You know, they suspended an everyday attitude and they went in to the spirit of the thing. That is what is going to happen again. We'll love the coronation. I'm looking forward to the coronation with all the joy of a child, actually. I'm really looking forward to the coronation. And when you ask me to reflect on it seriously, I almost feel miserable.
It does seem like an opportunity lost if the person who was coming into the role of defender of the faith took that seriously, practiced it seriously, and shared it seriously. It would seem many fruits would come from that, not just for the monarchy, but for the nation.
I think you're going to have to wait for the debate following it, because whatever oath is used at the coronation, whatever is said, whatever role other faiths have at the coronation, other than sitting down and just watching it, that will provoke a debate afterwards. And I've no doubt at all that the sorts of things we're discussing now will be discussed in a very much more general forum after the coronation. But we need to see what happens first.
If you'll permit a mix of transatlantic benedictions as departing words, I'd simply say, God bless Britain and God save the King.
God bless Britain and certainly God save the King.
Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're enjoying Crown and Crozier, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And we'd be grateful if you could help us reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. Also, we'd love to hear from you. Check out our website at crownandcrozier.com or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. We're sincerely grateful for your support, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship.